international reputation. Now, there's obviously something gone seriously wrong with this election project. Yeah, that most of the people here I recognize as friends and colleagues from my past. You'll be reassured to know that I still have an international reputation, but sadly it's confined to Edinburgh these days. It's a great pleasure for me to chair the seminar. And John's already said something about Alan. I met Alan for the first time last night. I'd heard a lot about him before, but he'd read some of his work. He seemed kind of subdued to me last night. He'd managed to get to Scotland, but seemed to have little prospect of getting out. And I was very relieved when I came home to see the first flight in to British airspace had actually come from Vancouver. And I detect already there's a kind of lightning in this. There's a spring in his step, and he's going to talk to us about the systems approach to getting evidence in policy.
Thank you, Eric. Well, I'm delighted to be here for several reasons, but hopefully not too much longer. Certainly the primary reason is because it's a rare opportunity to deal with a group like this where we can really start to talk about this as we think of the approach and what it might mean for us and how we can be working together to start to move into what we think is a bit of a new way of thinking, new way of doing things around evidence to policy. Also delighted because my ancestors come from Doon and it's just nice to feel back home. So it's great. If only I could figure out why am I not finding it?
Well, under you.
It's just that.
There, it doesn't help. Yeah. Thank you. Just
do you want to stick the mic on? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I'm not used to being told that my voice isn't booming enough. As John says, we've been friends for, I think it might be 3 decades. It's certainly getting up there. And neither of us get the cue to have a soft voice very often. So I think today, in a way, is a bit of, I'm not going to call it an experiment, but an exploration. It's really seeing if we can work together, what kind of ideas we've been developing and kind of make sense here, what works, what doesn't, and how can we come up with a way of looking at this and a way of talking about this that's really useful. We started out 10 years ago with some major long-term funding from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research that John used to be affiliated with. As it was first created, they introduced two what they called transition programs, which were designed to start to shift the culture of academia towards more of a partnership between the people producing the research and the people using it. And so with the encouragement of a former dean at UBC, we put in a proposal built around partnering. We've done a fair bit of that kind of thing in the past. We're successful. The following year got a training grant, so the 6 years were part of a strategic training program that was deliberately bringing people from the local health authorities and the university together to work collaboratively to start to figure out how to do research that would be more helpful to the decision maker and the policy setting needs of the authorities. We saw our mandate as focusing on improved integration of outcomes across the system, not just public health, but really the whole system, although my background is public health, and that's where I'm most comfortable. But as we worked over that decade, we increasingly found that we needed to have real expertise in other areas as well, including this thing I've called here knowledge exchange, goes by all kinds of different language terms, systems thinking and transdisciplinarity. A year and a half ago, I was invited to give a talk, not unlike today, in Oslo. I think it was your doing, Hugh, to get me involved in that. It was organized by Sandra Nutley and Sarah Morton, and they had a grant from the EU to work with 6 different countries around coordinating evidence and policy of funding. They started out very cleverly by having pictures around the outside of the room, that all kinds of photographic images and abstract pictures and so on. Everyone was to find something that really conveyed metaphorically something about how they thought about this whole evidence to policy that I hadn't seen. My picture wasn't there. I really wanted a picture of a bridge that had a house on it, where we could come together, live together, work together, because my sense from the Canadian experience is without that kind of a meeting place, it just doesn't happen. So I told this story at a conference a year ago, and the next day somebody had Googled and sent me this picture of the London Bridge in the 1600s. It's got houses, it's got shops, it's even got a chapel. That's my kind of bridge. And just quickly to overview where this journey of thinking about how best to build bridges has led us over the last decade, we started out, as I mentioned, with this Community Partnerships for Health Research, where we were really working very closely with local authorities. But a couple of things happened that I'll tell you more about. One was what was called the ISIS Project, Initiative for the Study and Implementation of Systems. It was funded by the National Institute of Health in the US and was a think tank where we brought together scholars from around the world who came from different disciplines to talk about systems, mathematics, engineering, ecology, management sciences. And our goal was to think about what can we learn from these other disciplines who have a much longer history of thinking about systems than we did, that we could adapt and translate to the needs in the health sector, particularly around population health. We used tobacco as the prototype, but it was really designed to think about a new way of doing public health, if you want. The second one was the National Cancer Institute of Canada, where we were charged with coming up with a common language and logic that would really work for everybody, from the basic to the clinical to the population scientists. But because cancer research in Canada is largely funded by volunteers and the fundraising efforts of the Canadian Cancer Society, it had to be a language that would work for their 300,000 volunteers too. It really needed to be a common base. So I'll tell you about some of the things that we came to with that. With that kind of thinking about the big picture behind us, we start to think about the ways in which the grant funding that we've been operating on for several years was getting in the way of doing what the decision makers and policy makers really needed. We created what we called the Dialogue on Health Systems Research and put together a series of extended breakfast sessions with 15 senior decision makers from the local authorities and government, 15 senior leaders from the universities, and just talked about. So, is there a disconnect between the people producing the research and the people using it? Why is that? What can we do to start to bring them back together? They fairly quickly came to the sobering conclusion that you can't get here from there, that there really is so much of a disconnect between the different worlds of the policymaker and the university, different cultures, different timelines, different funding sources, different pressures, that they found it almost impossible. They knew each other, occasionally they would meet, they knew they should be working together, but couldn't make it happen. They needed this London Bridge that we've been talking about. We talked for a little while about creating a not-for-profit with a board that was jointly populated by people from the university and from the health system. I think in many ways the Scottish collaboration is a brilliant experiment in this kind of bridge building that we're talking about. But our system, in times of fiscal constraint and the political slowness that usually comes from changing large systems, they couldn't get their heads around creating this kind of a not-for-profit that would virtually pool the talent. So at the end of the day, we've decided to do it ourselves. We think it's the right thing to do. So we've created a private research consulting group called InSource. And we basically say to organizations, if the research you need is strategically important where you're trying to take your organization, you don't want to outsource it. You want to insource it. Bring in a group you know and trust that will give you the research you need when you need it. And we're deliberately creating a blended funding model. We still do a lot of grant-funded research, and I'll tell you some about that. But at least for the moment, we've got a bridging model that we think works. And again, that'll be an interesting question for you to reflect on in terms of what kind of structures make the most sense in the Scottish environment. So the initiative on the study and implementation of systems basically was designed to learn from those other disciplines and in particular to produce some tools which might be useful in population health. And I'll come back and talk more about them later. The NCIC work that I mentioned briefly, when we looked at the literature with our working group, we found that there were essentially three different generations of thinking about how you move from evidence to policy. The first, which had been around for 30, 40 years, largely grounded in the work of Everett Rogers in the US, talked about innovation, dissemination, diffusion, knowledge transfer, knowledge update. You can see it's a model where the researchers are producing the knowledge and then handing it off to the people that are going to end up using it. The knowledge is a product, and it's the success of the transfer process is going to depend on how well you package it in a form that can be used by the decision makers. And there are going to be times when that kind of thinking is appropriate. For example, if we are trying to set up a vaccination program that would reach all the population, going to the schools and setting up a fairly simple lock-key kind of a system so every kid be inoculated, it's going to do a pretty good job. And that kind of linear thinking is just fine. But a lot of the public health problems that we're facing these days don't fit into that simple model. This is an example of what a linear model looks like when it's spelled out now. This was produced by Crowley and his colleagues with the Institute of Medicine in the US a few years ago. Some of these slides I've had to import the visual from the article as a JPEG, so that they're not going to be as clean on your slide as you'd like, but you've got some references. You can always follow up and look at the detail more if you want to. And this has become the dominant model in the US at the moment, despite the fact that it really only is well articulated from how you get from bench to bedside. It doesn't really do much about how you actually get to the full population health services after that. Starting about 15 years ago, and we're proud to say largely in Canada, we started to focus much more on a relationship model, to talk about the fact that these knowledge products are embedded within relationship. And it's the way that you work with each other that really is going to be what supports and fosters the kind of integration of evidence into policy that we're looking for. Jonathan Lomas was successful in creating the Canadian Health Services Research Foundation and had a very clear vision of what this linkage and exchange model might look like. And you can see that it's much more collaborative, people working together in partnership between doing the research and using the research, that you want to get the decision makers, policy makers involved early in the process to the extent that you can. Doesn't mean they have to walk lockstep with you at every step. That would be a little bit too much to expect and probably not even all that helpful necessarily. But at the beginning, in terms of framing, what are the important questions for what's the system struggling with today? And then at the end of the day, in terms of making sense of what the research says and whether it has anything to teach us, you need those kinds of partnerships. And the success is going to be a function of the degree to which you have effective relationships and networking across the system. This is a model that was produced by Ian Graham, who's now vice president of our Canadian Institute for Health Research for Knowledge Translation. He did it based on a systematic review of some 31 different planned action models. So it's actually very well-grounded, very sophisticated, and it's becoming the dominant model for knowledge exchange, knowledge translation work in Canada. I'm going to use the terms pretty interchangeably without a lot of worrying about the distinctions today. Ian ends up calling it knowledge to action. And one of the things I like about that term is it doesn't make any assumptions about what's happening in the middle. It says you start with knowledge, you end up with action, and then there can be a lot of creativity about how you get there. What he's done with this model is to put the traditional knowledge creation piece in the middle as a fairly straightforward linear process. But around the outside, he's mapped out 8 steps that the literature says are important to actually get implementation happening within the system. And at each of those steps, the article talks about the kinds of things that you need to be doing. It won't be as neat and linear as this circle around the outside suggests, but there's a lot of real wisdom and real evidence there for how you do start to get that kind of system change. I particularly like this model that Mike Kelly and Vince Beller produced for Scotland a few years ago. What I like about it, again, is it's one of those relationship circular kind of models, but it's starting in the middle pieces, if you can look at the detail, to do a couple of things. One is to introduce the importance of feedback loops, so you're learning as you go continuously. And the second is multi-level interventions, realizing there have to be things happening at the individual, organizational, and systems level to really expect to get uptake. But at the time we were doing this, starting about 5 years ago, there wasn't much in the literature, but our sense was that we were starting to see a third generation emerge. And it was based on this systems thinking. It was a recognition that the products are embedded within the relationships, but the relationships are embedded within systems. And unless you're evidence to policy strategy is well aligned with the organization's priorities and resources and capacity, it's not going to happen either. So that's what people have been working on over the last several years. That's what we ended up deciding, particularly for public health, was going to be critical, because so many of the priority challenges in public health are ones of complex adaptive systems, where it doesn't lend itself to the kind of simpler approaches that have shown in the earlier models. There is no, I think, really good systems model yet for how this works. But this example from the Canadian Heart Health Initiative starts to move in that direction It starts to spell out some of the things that the different partners need to be doing with each other. It starts to highlight the importance of feedback loops. Certainly would encourage you to go and look at that kind of article as a way to start that sort of thinking in a very practical kind of way. It's a model that's well-kept and well-used in Canada. Emerge ground up from the different partners that we're working together on heart health. So it's worth a look. I don't know how it all fits together. What we're starting to feel is that you have to do some things initially around system readiness to really prepare it for this kind of thing. And maybe that's what we're doing today, is starting to think about what that partnership looks like, what kind of leadership is going to be required for this to work, what kind of resources and regulations provide the framework for this action. But then once we've got some of that readiness in place, we can start to think about the different models that we've just been talking about, some of the structures and relationships that will be necessary to implement them, and so on, okay? Let me switch gears a little bit and tell you about a meta-narrative review that we're just finishing off now, again, CIHR funded. But we wanted to take that review and the thinking that we've done within the NCIC and really get it well grounded in the literature in terms of the models that are out there now. So this funding is to review the different conceptual models for knowledge action that are currently having the greatest influence, and to try to figure out what the different ones are saying and how we can start to move towards a common understanding. If you look at the detail, again, you won't see it on the screen, but I hope it shows up well enough on your handout. You can start to see that it's a pretty traditional kind of approach to knowledge synthesis initially, in terms of searching for all the relevant literature and extracting the key messages from that. But then it departs. This meta-narrative, you may remember, was developed by Tricia Greenthal several years for the National Health Services. When she was asked to do a review of diffusion into public sector organizations, I think that's not quite the right title, but close.
Sustainability and spread.
Thank you. Massive review. Basically what she did was to find traditional methods wouldn't work. She could identify 13 different traditions of working on the diffusion agenda, and to essentially tell the stories through a qualitative narrative interpretation of how those different traditions had grown over time. And that provided a very rich picture of the kinds of things that are known from the full range of disciplines that make a difference in terms of the outcomes. So what we're doing here is working with Trish and doing that kind of narrative story development of the different traditions that we could identify within the conceptual models literature. We just had a workshop 3 weeks ago with decision makers and program managers from our system so that we could share with them what we were finding and get their input to that. So we're just ready to kind of tie it up now. But I can show you some preliminary ideas about what we think we're learning or coming up with. To my chagrin, it didn't come out in nice, neat piles around linear relation and system models the way I thought it was going. In fact, what we found is that all of the different models since that original linear model have been struggling with this question of how do we get our arms around the complexity of the system. They've been bringing in different aspects of it in terms of the relationships or capacity building or policy changes. None of them really have done a full job yet, and they come down in different places on some important dimensions. So we're going to summarize the literature based on the tensions that we see between these different fundamental dimensions along which the programs, frameworks seem to vary. I was in Durham last week as part of their Center of Excellence for Public Health, and we actually used the 7 tensions that came out of this as a basis for talking about the work that their center is doing and the diversity of thinking within their center in terms of how you move forward. So let me share a couple of them with you to just give you a bit of a sense of what we're doing. We identified 7 in all, and you can see on these slides that some of them have to do with the basic theoretical, scientific, conceptual approach to this, with whether we see the system as something we can manage or as a complex system that really is beyond management. Some of them have to do with the nature of the problem in terms of where we're not working the right ways to produce the knowledge, to integrate it, to transfer it. Some of them have to do with the different strategies in terms of how you go about implementation, and the models do vary in terms of why they were put together in the first place. Some really were more just to try to better understand the problem. Most of them are to try to do something about the problems. Okay. One of them, for example, is where we locate the problem. Is it a problem of production transfer or utilization? We're using five different kinds of models. Glad to share the details of it with you. I thought it was too much for today. But basically, you can see that the different models are clustering around a common point. This is the CIHR model, which I did share with you, Allison Kitson's Perry's model, a model by Réjean Landry, which talks about research utilization. What makes it different than some of the others is it's entirely based on an empirical approach, where you're starting with surveys of decision makers and how they're actually making decisions, and then developing that the kind of indicators that are necessary to study it further. But no big news. Basically, the models are not varying too much along that dimension, probably not that different. They're all tending towards an understanding of transfer and uptake that's more or less the same. This tension, in contrast, is quite different and really fundamental. The models differ in terms of whether you think they can, you can plan the change, organize, train, manage it effectively, or it really is a complex system where you can't drive it. The best you can do is foster the relationship, to build capacity, and then in a sense to let it happen. And on this model, there's huge variation. So that there really are some fundamental differences that we need to work through in terms of how we partner together, what we think that process is going to look like. Well, so what? We think that we're going to end up concluding that context really does count, and that we need a much better understanding of where we're using these different models if we try to decide which ones are going to be best suited. The complex systems are going to be the rule rather than the exception in public health, and we need to accept that and to learn to deal with it. That these complex problems are going to require complex solutions. Simply relying on any one tool, whether it be policy or programming or education or whatever, isn't going to do the job. It's going to take a mix of things. That collaboration and capacity are going to be the critical factors, and that it's learning how to work together, how to learn together, how to build those skills and that capacity, get the resources in place, that's going to be critical. Especially important, we think, are going to be some key issues around effective networking, leadership, strategic communications, which are whole areas of themselves that have not yet been well integrated into the evidence and policy piece, but need to be. So we're talking about a real paradigm shift, perhaps, from a reductionist, machine-like kind of a mechanism of understanding, which is what is the fundamental foundation for clinical medicine, works well for a lot of the interventions, if I can call them that, that are happening in a clinical context, as opposed to complexity science, where we understand the system much more as an organic thing, where we know some of the principles of what makes those complex systems work in terms of feedback loops and learning by adaptation and so on, multiple causal factors interacting, multiple levels of intervention, high dependence on context dependency, and a recognition that the science we need is not so much one that controls for all the possible things that might affect the outcomes. That's not possible when you have a complex system like this, but rather one that focuses on external validity, the extent to which the science is relevant and useful to the particular problem for which you're trying to use it. Generally, we're looking at a transformation in leadership already. I suspect that not much of this sounds very new to you. There's a real groundswell for realizing that to manage these complex organizations, we need to do things differently. And there's some specific differences around the leadership style that are demanded if you accept the view that it is a complex system in which you're working. It has to do with much greater use of facilitation and empowerment, letting go, letting the real agents, the frontline people in the system who are going to be creating the change, do the thinking and organizing the change. Rather than having discrete kind of annual evaluations for how we're doing, a continuous evaluation process that lets us understand in a much more nuanced way what's going on and to continuously improve. And a lot more focus on partnership, on alignment, on getting all the different stakeholders in the system who are working on these larger problems to figure out what their specific role is and how they can work together. It means a shift in the kind of research that we do from what Gibbons called mode one to mode two research. Mode one is the one we all know and love, where an investigator gets a bright idea, gets a grant, does a study, publishes, and there you go, contributes to the body of knowledge, as opposed to mode two science, which doesn't start with an investigator, it starts with a real problem, puts together the team that's going to be necessary to deal with all aspects of the problem. They learn together by doing, using a variety of different methods. And the major result is learning something about what's going to work in this situation. It may or may not be generalizable to other situations, but as we do more and more of this mode two research across a wide variety of situations, we're going to start to see what works, what doesn't, as a replication logic rather than a randomization logic for learning important lessons about this. And we may come back to that, because that really is the key to learning about how these complex systems work, is figuring out how we can better learn from the natural experiments, if you will, that are going on. Quickly, I'm going to walk you through some of the tools that we developed with the ISIS project that may or may not be helpful to you as you start to think about how do you shift into more of a complexity world, how do you start to build more of these partnerships. You're going to give me a high sign for 5 minutes, aren't you? I'm going to go fairly quickly over these tools because each of them is huge, has a lot behind it, and then if there are any that particularly pique your interest, you can ask about it, I can send you articles about it. But let me just quickly walk you through some of these methods. When we started to sit down with the policymakers, decision makers in our system to make sense of what we were running with that ISIS project, we had these four whole system tools that we'd developed. They had a whole lot of things that they were already trying to do to be more evidence-based in the way they operated. And we started to realize that we needed both, we needed to put them together, and if we could coordinate that different kind of knowledge, we could start to create strategic change and rapid learning systems that would be in the best interest. This is the first of those tools. It's a concept mapping tool. Basically, what you do is you get hundreds, thousands of people, everybody you can imagine that might be part of the solution, together in a virtual room. It's all web-based, and what you get people to do is to first brainstorm a single question to which you're trying to get some sort of a sense of direction. In this case, one specific component of a strong tobacco control program is. In this particular one, I think we had something like 400 different people brainstorming. We came up with something like 600 separate different ideas. A group of knowledgeable people about the methodology in the content area then get together and distill that down to about 100 items that are, by combining the ones that are basically saying the same thing, different language, cleaning it up a little bit. And then it goes back on the web for these people to talk about how they would sort those out, which ones seem to go together. What they see is the relative feasibility and importance of those different interventions. And it comes back at the end of the day with a multivariate analysis which produces this map. You can start to see some of the things that come out as being important dimensions for system change, some of the things that are important dimensions for individual change. And essentially it starts to provide a roadmap, a common language, a common way of looking at the problem so that people can see, oh yeah, well if we do all these things in combination and orchestrate it, that really would be an integrated strategy. System dynamics modeling. This is a fairly simple piece of a much larger map that starts to look at what are some of the key pieces in the puzzle, smokers and non-smokers, smoking as it's developed as a norm in society, the tobacco growers, a variety of different players or pieces in the action, if you want. And then it starts to look at the interactions and dynamics amongst them. That's what the arrows are, the feedback loops, so that as you start to get more people quitting smoking, it starts to reinforce and strengthen a non-smoking norm, and that becomes a virtuous cycle, we're always getting better. On the other hand, if you start to increase price for tobacco, start to drive down consumption, so that's a negative feedback cycle, and you can start to see, and indeed mathematically model, should you want to go that far, how these kinds of pieces in the puzzle fit together. And this is the famous Tricia Greenhalgh slide, which has everything in it, but what do you do with it? It's just too big. And Trish herself would recognize it. It's too big to really deal with pragmatically. It's not a dynamic model because it doesn't talk about the relationships we've just been talking about. This is a simpler map that we're using for a project we're currently doing in Arizona, based in Arizona, but it involves every state and province in Canada and the U.S. Each of those 62 geographic political units has a toll-free number you can call if you want to quit smoking, you need help finding the right resources. They're all trying to be evidence-based, they're all trying to implement the same set of standards, but they do it differently depending on the local context and the resources and what they have available and so on. So there's a coalition of these 62 which are trying to learn from each other and to do it better. On top of that, We've developed a 5-year research program to try to really better understand the dynamics of that system. So we're focusing on network analysis as a tool that will drive the change in the system. The stronger the network, the better the decisions, the more the knowledge integration in a virtuous cycle, but also the local context, whether they've got a good relationship history of working together, whether the resources and the leadership are there, that's going to make a big difference. The effect of this coalition head office is going to make a difference, sometimes positive, sometimes negative. So that's our first attempt to take the variables from the Greenhalgh Review that are relevant, most relevant to this particular situation, and to start to put them into a dynamic model so we can see how it will work. So the network analysis lets you learn a lot more about how the different organizations are working together effectively. This is an interesting study that compared Indiana 2002 and 2004. One of the indicators you can get from the analysis of getting everybody to tell you what they're doing with each other is a measure of centrality, the extent to which it's really being run out of a lead agency or head office, if you want. And you can see in the 2002 that the centrality was reasonably high. A lot of people were interconnected, but through this hub in the middle, centrality of 0.23. 2 years later, the centrality measure had been cut in half. That's because the governor took away half the funding. So that suddenly there just wasn't as much resource for the coordination, and it had to move to much more of a decentralized sharing of leadership kind of a model. It's still a strong network, but it's more decentralized rather than centralized. So it gives you a feel for some of the dynamics and some of the lessons that you can learn from this kind of measurement. On the knowledge side, we found that the single most important thing we needed to do was to develop a methodology that would let us do rapid reviews with the decision makers. So what we did was to take the realist review methodology that Ray Fawson and his colleagues in England have developed, and to follow through essentially the same steps that a Cochrane review goes through, but at each step, you're using an a priori theoretical lens so that if the research answers aren't all there, and they won't be for a lot of the public health challenges we face, you at least have an evidence-grounded theory that provides your best understanding of what's probably going on in that situation. What we've then done is to wed that to a cycle that lets us move more quickly. We get an expert panel from around the world and have them work virtually on the internet to help us refine the questions, find the right articles, draw some meaningful conclusions. And these are the people who are the content experts who are doing a lot of the leading research in the area, so that we're pretty confident that by working closely with them, we come up with something that's at least as rigorous, perhaps more rigorous, than a traditional sitting in a library trying to fit it all together. We also have a local reference group that we are constantly checking with, so that these are the people who are going to use the evidence to make sure that the way we're asking the question, the kind of inferences we're drawing, makes sense in their world. This is one, again, we did for the National Institutes of Health in the U.S. on inter-organizational partnerships. And you can see there's some six critical success factors the literature says you have to pay serious attention to if you want to build a coalition across a number of agencies to tackle common problems. They have to have clear common aims, which are consistent with but different than and rising above the goals of their own organizations. You have to build trust, one step at a time perhaps, but you can't run ahead of the level of trust that you're building. Different style of leadership we've talked about, sensitivity to power issues. Membership structures, each of the organizations needs to start to get really quite clear of what's its role, how they're going to be working together, how a decision's going to get made, and action learning. We're just starting a new project with the Saskatchewan government. I'm thrilled about it. It's a pilot project where the decision makers get to decide what the researchers' questions are going to be. In this particular case, every 6 months, the provinces that are in the pilot get to frame a question, and Saskatchewan said it needs one on large system transformation. They're doing a variety of projects around surgical wait lists and patient and family-centered care, refining public primary health care models. They're doing a lean project. I'm going to make sure that they get a public health project in there so we make sure it's the same kind of thing. And they know some of the principles they think that they have to work with, but they particularly want a review, an in-depth review around what's the role of government, what's the role of policy, how do you use the levers the government has available effectively if you're moving towards large system change. One of the things we're going to do, because we expect there actually isn't a lot of research that we're going to be able to find and synthesize, is to come up with new methodologies that will do a better job of capturing the tacit wisdom that the people who are doing this day by day are accumulating. It isn't in the literature yet. So we're going to put together a consensus network of, say, 50 to 100 people around the world who are doing this kind of thing, interacting with them to make sure that we're finding the right articles, drawing the right conclusions. And we also want a learning network. We want other organizations which are trying to do similar kinds of things in a way that collaboration is doing that kind of thing. And to work with, say, half a dozen of these so that we can each share what we're learning, what we're bringing to the table. Saskatchewan brings the systematic review. Other people may bring case studies, whatever it is, so that together we can be learning and kind of drawing common wisdom that combines research knowledge, theory knowledge, and practice knowledge. Very quickly, and then I'm going to end, Dave. How am I doing? Is this about right?
Okay.
Oh, no more. I promise. I should warn him, he's got a very long hook if I'm not careful. If we were to take all this seriously, we're going to have to do some serious thinking about the systems within which we work. Academia is not well designed for this kind of fluid collaboration. There are all kinds of things that get in the way around tenure and promotion and intellectual property and that kind of conflict of interest, that kind of stuff. There's a lot of pressure, but certainly universities have not moved far down this path yet. And there has to be some serious conversation about if we want to see researchers more engaged with the health system and other social systems to kind of create social good, how does the university have to structure itself for that? The health system has to do some thinking about how it changes too. The two biggest problems I run into in British Columbia are a difficulty allocating resources. Essentially, all of our systems are in tight money times and running up big deficits. It's very hard to set aside money for R&D, which has to be taken away from patient services to do that. So it's tough. The second big one is that I think partly because of the complexity and the extent to which people are pushed these days in government and the health system, they can almost get their heads around some of the smaller incremental changes that would improve the system. And there are all kinds of improvement initiatives on the go. What they can't do is get their arms around transformative change, the kind of things that Saskatchewan's talking about. They know they need to, but it's just too big, too much. And so how are we going to realign our health system so that there is a greater investment in learning, there is a greater investment in using evidence and policy, and in building the necessary capacity instead of setting the resources for the kind of work that we're doing here. And then finally, there may need to be some real fundamental shifts in the way we think about science. Certainly our biomedical colleagues have trouble with a lot of the things we're talking about today. They're not as they don't feel as rigorous, they don't feel as controlled as they ought to be. That may be a misperception, but we need to have the conversation and to really start to think through what the full range of science should be for the kinds of things that we're talking about. I'll leave you with a Vancouver sunset, and do we have a couple of minutes for questions?
Well, thanks, Alan. You're going to get an opportunity to hear Alan again. We're going to have a lot of time at the end for a panel discussion, but we'll take any points of clarification that you might have now. And if you want to speak, just say again, press this button that lights up your mic, and tell us who you are, because they're hoping to transcribe the proceeding. Any points of clarification you want to take at this stage? Now, I think we need no clarification. It was a masterpiece of clarity.
Lovely.
We'll